Tank Commander, From the Cold War to the Gulf and Beyond, is a new book by Stuart Crawford. It's a personal memoir of more than 20 years in the 4th Royal Tank Regiment, Scotland's own, all the way from West Germany through to the Gulf and beyond. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK. I'm Stuart Crawford. Stuart, good morning to you. And where are you this morning?
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. I'm actually I actually live just outside Edinburgh, so I guess Edinburgh in Scotland is the closest.
That will do. It's an interesting memoir, and I suppose every little boy, I was just saying this to the breakfast presenter, every little boy had the Action Man tank at some stage. So we ought to be a tank commander. So how did you begin your career in the 4th Royal Tank Regiment?
Well, it's one of these things I can't really explain. Really, from very early teen years, say 12 or 13, I just was interested in things military and thought that I wanted to be a soldier. And I wanted to be a tank soldier because I was fascinated by tanks in the same sort of way that people are interested in train spotting or collecting stamps. It's really quite difficult to explain. And I don't actually come from what you might call the sort of classic British military officer background. Because although both my dad and my grandfather had been in uniform, you know, during or just at the end of the Second World War and during the First World War, there wasn't a long tradition of Crawford serving on the northwest frontier in India or anything like that. But there was there was obviously a military tradition. But I think that's the same for almost every family in the UK of my generation, really, that at some point someone in the family had been involved in things military because of the two world wars. My dad had been to Sandhurst. He'd been called up as a private soldier just at the end of the Second World War, sent down to Catterick, where all the square bashing for the infantry was done, and he did 6 weeks there, and then at some point his company commander called him in and said, "Well, you know, we think you should go to Sandhurst for officer training." And of course, he was a clever guy, my dad, very talented in many ways, but he was just a boy from a village in south of Glasgow. Anyway, off he went to Sandhurst, got admitted, and ended up next door room to the Duke of whatever it was, Wellington or something.
Right.
So it was, and he always spoke very fondly of it, and he spent his 2 years national service as a lieutenant in the Highland Light Infantry, which is the Glasgow, or was the Glasgow and Ayrshire Regiment, in Palestine. And there was some interesting stuff that came out of that, including in those days when you were an officer, you got a baton, you know, a sort of personal servant that sort of sorted things out while you were marking maps and taking orders. And his first baton, when he got to Palestine in Rafah, was a German soldier who'd been captured at El Alamein. All I know is his name was Helmut. He came from Hamburg. He didn't know if his family was alive or dead because Hamburg, as you know, was hugely bombed during the war. But all these things sort of just built up until I got to the point where I thought, well, I better go and have a go at this. Long answer to a short question.
I better go and have a go at this. But it's interesting because a lot of people sort of, and you mentioned that because our grandfathers were in the Second World War, and also you mentioned the military service, and of course that wasn't disbanded until the late 50s. So there was a lot of people. My uncle served in Malaya, for example. Again, because it was part of what you did. But there's a lot of, you mentioned the whole thing about you're always interested in tanks and that thing. But there's an awful lot of wanting, of being interested in them, because I, you know, quite fancied, I was in the cadets, etc., and I was liked my military history and the whole bit, and then the harsh reality set in of, you know, tropesing across Oakhampton or something, and you think, okay, well, maybe the soldiering isn't it for me. So the reality of being involved in mechanized infantry or tanks, whatever, were they quite different from what you imagined then when you first, and do you get dropped in? Because I know absolutely nothing about tanks, just to let you know, Stuart. So do you get dropped in as a tank commander, or do you work your way up from the driver position? I mean, how does it work?
Right, well, of course there's a lot of stuff in there. Taking the last item first, as a tank commander, as a young officer, you become a tank commander. because that's what you're trained for. So you do the Sandhurst thing, and then you, in my day, you went down to Bovington Camp, where they still go, in Dorset, and you learn how to become a tank troop leader. And eventually, if you complete that successfully, which most people do, you'll be posted to your regiment and you command a troop of three tanks. So three tanks, and it's still the case now, would be yourself and 11 other guys. And you would command that. If you join the ranks as a private soldier, you would work your way up to being a tank commander through various stages. So you might join as a gunner, or you might join as a driver, and then you do courses and course. I mean, the military is very good at sort of building up education. And there's a whole topic about social mobility through service in the armed services, which we obviously don't have time for today, but it's very interesting sort of academic topic, actually. So yeah, I mean, I arrived as a troop leader on the tank park where we paraded every morning in Munster in West Germany, as it was then, and, you know, stood in front of my new troop, hoping to God that they would like me. And looking them over and thinking, oh, you know, they look quite a fierce bunch, and no doubt they were doing exactly the same things, thinking, who on earth have they sent us now? But we got on fine.
And you mentioned Munster. It is another world, isn't it? Now it's 40 years ago, but do you think we've almost forget what it was like with the British Army presence in Germany? It goes back since 45. And there were huge amounts of British and obviously American troops over there, because that's where we thought the next threat was coming from.
Yeah. No, we were. I mean, we used to think that we wouldn't last very long if it ever, became a serious war against the Warsaw Pact, as it was then. Looking at what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, I mean, they always say you shouldn't underestimate your enemy, because that's, you know, the route to failure. But it's also quite dangerous to overestimate your enemy. And looking at the competency of the or the presented and what we've seen of the Russian armies in Ukraine, we have to wonder whether we were slightly too worried about it or not. But no, when I was in Germany in the 1980s, the tank fleet of the British Army of the Rhine, as it was called then, was 900 tanks. We've now got 227. And that's going down to 148. So there's been a huge diminishing in the British military presence, not just overseas, because we're not in Germany anymore, apart from a small presence in Senelager, but also in the UK as a whole.
So you from Germany and having that sort of, if you being that buffer behind the Iron Curtain, or being that you know, that security behind the Iron Curtain, and then you find yourself in the Gulf War, and presumably that's a terrain, because when you think tanks, you think sort of rolling fields, don't you? So especially for tank warfare, having, you know, if anybody who's watched, I don't know, Battle of the Bulge or something. So therefore when it came to being deployed to the Gulf, that must have been an interesting one, because obviously not a lot of air conditioning in the modern tank, I would imagine, and dust getting. I was speaking to somebody about Chinooks the other day, and he said, yeah, you know, dust getting everywhere and sand getting absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, by the time that the Gulf War came along, I had sort of ended up on the staff, actually. So I had a pretty easy Gulf War. I spent 3 months in the Marriott Hotel in Riyadh on the staff of Headquarters British Forces.
That must have been a tough posting for you there, Stuart.
Well, you know, it was really, really boring, and we envied the guys that were up in the desert. Obviously, you know, I made a couple of trips up the desert and met various people that I knew who were actually doing it for real. But my boss was General Sir Peter de la Billière, who commanded all the British forces in theatre, and he was a really thoroughly decent bloke. And it also allowed me to observe the whole war rather than just a little bit that was in front of me. So, and my regiment as a whole didn't deploy to the Gulf. It became a sort of spares battalion, and they took all our gun. We had 57 Chieftain tanks in Germany at the time, and all the tank gun barrels were removed, all the gearboxes were removed, all sent as spares to the Gulf. So it wasn't a particularly inspiring time.
Did you do some time with the UN as well? Was it Cyprus you were?
Yeah, we did. We had a 6-month tour of Cyprus, of which 3 months was in the sovereign base area, Dhekelia. It's sort of contiguous Ayas Nikolaos listening station, which we don't talk very much about. But so that was a sovereign base area, which was just a relic of British occupation of Cyprus historically. And then we did 3 months on the, what they call the Green Line, the UN manned or staffed, I suppose is more accurate now, buffer zone between the Turks and the Greeks. And it was sold to us as a bit of a sunshine posting and a bit of a jolly and a holiday. I mean, I thoroughly disliked it. I just thought the whole thing was sort of mildly pointless, actually, and a bit petty. Mm. But, you know, there you are. You don't pick and choose where you go.
I'm leaping up and down across the chronology here, but when you were in Germany, presumably you took place in some of these big NATO exercises that we used to have in the 80s in West Germany. They must have been quite you know, it's fun. They must have been sort of, that's what you were soldiering for. If you weren't actually going to war or peacekeeping, then getting involved in these huge exercises where you are thundering across
I mean, quite extraordinary. The biggest one was an exercise called Exercise Lionheart. And I think it was 1984. I can't remember exactly. It's in the book anyway. Yeah. And we were actually stationed in the south of England for 2 years at that point. But the whole of the British Army of the Rhine deployed to exercise the whole outloading from the UK. And so we went with our vehicles from Tidworth and Salisbury Plain all the way out to some village, which I forget, in Germany. And we did this by combination of road transport. The tanks went by Royal Fleet Auxiliaries to Zeebrugge, were offloaded, then onto trains, and they were railroaded up to into Germany. And it was practicing the whole deployment thing. Wow. And it was a huge operation. And then we had the tactical bit, and the German army and the US army sort of played enemy, and we did all the maneuvers, you know, defense, counterstroke, da da da. And you know, if you're looking at it on a map, you think, oh, what, you know, that must really, really exciting. The reality down at ground level is that, you know, you move somewhere and wait for a week,
yeah,
and then you move for 24 hours, and then it's all over. But you know, that's people who've actually been in action properly say it's sort of 90% boredom and 10% utter frightening excitement.
You talk about the Americans and the only thing I can remember is the Abrams tank, which is this massive behemoth of a what tank were you commanding, and did you look over at the Americans?
We were in Chieftain tanks, which was but probably by the time I was involved in the 1980s, was at the end of its working life. It had a great gun, the British rifled 120mm gun, and you know, you could hit anything with a decent gunner. But the engine was chronically unreliable. And so the boys, as we all call the soldiers, were sort of slaves to maintenance of their tanks and barracks, which is a bit of a shame. The Americans had introduced the Abrams, which was much more modern and is still in service after many, many upgrades. But the problem with that is it's got a very powerful engine, but it's a huge fuel consumption.
Yeah.
And then the Germans had Leopard 2, which, you know, is almost in a class of its own, in my opinion, for reliability and speed and all that sort of stuff. It's a bit like this of the BMW.
I was going to say, do you get tank envy? You know, you're sitting there going,
with the German tank, definitely, yes.
But the other thing is that you mentioned that quite shocking cutting back in the number of tanks, 900 down to, The Ministry of Defence, in their wisdom, and I'm doing parentheses here, would argue that because of the nature of modern warfare that we're kind of seeing in Ukraine at the moment, with Ukrainians dropping drones and dropping improvised hand grenades down, you know, the open turrets, as it were, that we don't need such a huge tank presence, and that light mobile infantry or whatever is the way to go.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a certain amount of bias in the media coverage, because the truth of the matter is that it's not just the Russians who are using tanks and armored fighting vehicles, it's also the Ukrainians. And you don't see the Ukrainians saying, oh, no, we're going to give our tanks up because, you know, everything gets destroyed from the air. And there is a theory, and I'm sympathetic to it, is that the whole idea of loitering munitions and killer drones, whatever you want to call them, have sort of developed into what we would call a threat vacuum, in that they've turned up and nobody's thought anything, a bit like the tank did in 1916 when it was first introduced. It was introduced into a threat vacuum. There was nothing that could knock it out. when it was first deployed. Now we're seeing more and more systems that are optimized against drones. And so I think that in terms of moving around the battlefield, protected mobility is of the essence. And that's what you get from a tank.
And also, there's a huge psychological inversion, isn't it? If I'm sort of wading through a muddy field somewhere, feeling a bit exposed, and suddenly I recognise there's a tank at one of my sides, it's going to make you feel an awful lot better in terms of morale, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's quite impressive. I mean, we used to train in Canada on the open prairies of Alberta, where we had a huge training facility there, which is the only place that we, at that time, that we could actually maneuver and fire live ammunition.
Ooh.
And seeing a squadron of tanks and a company of infantry attack a sort of, you know, a mock objective firing live ammunition is quite impressive. You know, you wouldn't want to be at the receiving end of it voluntarily.
And when you're at the delivering end of it, i.e. you're sitting there in the turret, you think, how the vibration, the shock, the pressure, I should imagine, of a live round going off must be quite something.
Yeah, you don't hear it so much inside the turret, funnily enough. Outside, because it's high velocity and breaks the speed of sound, the crack from the gun firing will damage your hearing. But inside, there's more a sort of shift in pressure, but it isn't oppressive. But in terms of dust and noise and just the sheer exhaustion of movement, it's really quite something.
You left soldiering after 20 years, and also in parallel to that, because people will say, and I know it's a bit of a horror cliche, but the army can teach you, or only the military can teach you, so much more. And you were doing, is it correct, you were doing sort of side courses in race relations, or you were at Glasgow University, or did that come later?
Yeah, no, I did that. I was very lucky to get a MOD funded research fellowship, basically. Of which there are usually two awarded a year across all three services, and it's something I always wanted to do. I don't classify myself as an academic because I don't think I am, but I wanted to do that academic study. So I had a year at Glasgow University, which is my hometown, obviously, and looking into race relations in the British Army, not the recruiting side, but what was actually happening inside. And some of the stuff I discovered, you know, was quite shocking, because my conclusion was that the British Army is institutionally racist. And the sad thing is, I don't know if things have got much better today.
And that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you think about the regiments that, you know, we used to be. And I mean, they've all sort of been amalgamated. I mean, those things, like you were saying, the Glasgow Regiment was the light infantry. And of course, you know, every county had, I don't know, South Staffs, for example. And now it's become, you know, South Staffordshire, for example, has become the Mercia, or the West, or the Mercia Regiment.
Yeah, big regiments.
Yeah, but you think about there were the Indian regiments, we had the Gurkhas before, and Fijians have had a huge, especially, you know, South Africans, Canadians, Aussie. I mean, we've had such a mixture of nationalities that come to the conclusion that it's institutionally racist is, I suppose, not a bit of a shock, but a bit of disappointment.
Yeah, I just. When I was doing all this stuff and I did it pretty thoroughly, actually, I have to say, with the MOD's help, I just felt, you know, yeah, this is a bit, we should be better than this. We should look after our people better than this. And at that time we didn't. I mean, improvements have been made. There's no doubt about it. But I think if you speak to soldiers of BAME ethnic origin, if you like, if I can put it that way, they'll still say to a certain extent that they face barriers which other people don't.
When you left the army, did you take the decision to go into politics? Did it happen? Did you want to get involved with Scottish Parliament?
I did. I left the army to stand as a candidate in the Scottish parliamentary elections in 1999.
Right.
For the SNP, which came as a huge shock to lots of people because the SNP was hardly seen as establishment. But the MOD, I have to say, the MOD was very good about it. And they said, well, you know, go and do this. And you have to resign your commission. That's what the Queen's regulations, as they were at the time, said. But if you don't get in, which I thought was very kind of him, you know, if you don't succeed, then, you know, just rejoin and we'll take you back at the same rank and the same such and such, which was fantastically generous offer, actually, I have to say. But at the time I thought, well, you know, once you've gone, you've gone, and I'll just go and do something else. So.
And I mean, we could now spend the rest of the afternoon talking about the SNP, the British Army, what would happen, etc. Not even mention full stuff, you know, the false lane bases. So, but why did you decide to put all this down? I mean, it's been very entertaining, and you've got a couple of pictures that you took yourself, and it's also, if you like, some ponderings on the nature of warfare and the morality of warfare, which, you know, I do quite a few books, military book interviews, and they tend to be, well, I went there and then I went there and then we did that. But your book is a little bit different on that. It's not saying, oh, well, you know, we went through Canada and we shot off live wires and then we found ourselves in, you know, in the hellhole that was in Dubai or wherever you were entering the Gulf.
Yeah, Riyadh.
Yes, the hellhole. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that you can actually ponder sort of the morality of war as well as the mechanics of war.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I actually set out. I won't give you the deep background to this, but I've always done a bit of freelance writing, sometimes paid, sometimes just for fun. And I was writing for a blog, an online blog in Scotland called Think Scotland, which covers all spectrums. And funnily enough, I was writing about other things. I was writing about, you know, public transport. I was writing about the community radio station that I got involved with as a presenter for a while. And during one of these, when I was writing about community radio, I said that, you know, trying to be a presenter and a producer at the same time with all the levers and dials and buttons and clocks and things was more difficult than commanding a squadron of tanks. And the guy who ran the blog, a guy called Brian Monteith, who is fairly well known in Scottish circles as a member of the Scottish, former member of the Scottish Parliament, and then an MEP, said, "If you commanded a squadron of tanks, why don't you write about it for my blog?" So I started, and it sort of grew and grew and grew. And eventually, people said, "You know, do you think there's a book in this?" And that just coincided with a Pen and Sword Books, commissioning editor, tweeting that, you know, if anyone's got anything they think that we might be interested in, send it in and we'll give you the nod. So I did. And of course, the answer came back, well, yes, we'll do it. And of course, that really called your bluff, doesn't it? You've got about a quarter, a third of a book written in small episodes. And they said, okay, then, 75,000 words, you know.
By Tuesday.
When can you deliver? But I wrote it, first of all, because I thought it was interesting to me and interesting to some of the soldiers that I served with. But I also wrote it on the basis that I would like to make it amusing, if not whimsical, but also have some serious points about the morality of war. And that comes out during the end phase of the Gulf War, also commenting on things like, you know, equipment procurement and stuff like that we don't do well. Mm. So there'll be, I hope it makes people smile. There are some serious bits in it. Some of it's a bit sentimental, if I'm honest about it. And I think that some of the, what I call the old and bold in the leather armchairs in the London clubs will be irritated by it. And that's maybe not a bad thing.
I was about to say that's no bad thing, Stuart. No bad thing at all. The very thought you just said that about how having been a tank commander, you could actually produce your own show. I'm just looking at my desk at the moment because I too produce my own show. And the very thought of them letting me loose with anything bigger than a go-kart would strike.
Well, you're a better man than I, because I found it incredibly difficult. My son, who was doing it as well, of course, you know, he's 27. I mean, it was easy, like falling off a log for him. And I was saying, well, which button is it next?
Trust me, Stuart, on this one, it's like the proverbial duck above water. The book is called Tank Commander: From the Cold War to the Gulf and Beyond. It's out now on Pen and Sword Books. It's by Stuart Crawford, who is speaking today. Stuart, if people want to find you online, there are blogs, there's a social media presence. Where can they find you and track you down in the nicest possible way?
Well, I'm on Twitter, and my handle, if I can, is that the
CB?
Correct?
I think that was CB, wasn't it, parlance? So there you go, but anyway.
It's at 509298, at 509298, which is my old army number.
I was going to say, 509298, at 509298.
Yeah, on Twitter. And then I'm on LinkedIn just under my own name, and also on Facebook just under my own name. So,
well, it's been fascinating to speak to you. Congratulations on the book. Stuart Crawford, author of Tank Commander, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles.